on. We've got to really just hit this thing as fast as we can. So we're going to go ahead and get started. I invite you to turn to Ezekiel chapter 4. We're going to be looking there, be looking at 4, 5, 6, and 24 this morning. Before we jump into that, though, let's have a word of prayer. Philip Box, can I get you to lead us in that? Okay, the book of Ezekiel, two weeks ago, we talked about the commission of Ezekiel, that God has hand-selected Ezekiel to go throughout the territory in Babylon where the exiles from the second deportation are gathered, and to preach to them and to try to move them in such a way that he can use them for his future plans down the road. The ultimate future that God has, not short-term, not long-term, the middle-term goal that God has for his people is to eventually bring them back to Jerusalem, to restore them. The captivity that he has for them is only going to be about 70 years. But before he can bring them back and give them hope that they're coming back, he's got to see some penitence on their part. He's got to bring them to repentance. But you can't bring a person to repentance who doesn't really accept responsibility for their actions. And so the other thing that he's trying to do through Ezekiel is get the people to come face to face to their sin, to own up to their mistakes so that they can repent. But before he even does that, God is going to use Ezekiel to try to get any denial out of their heads that they are going home anytime soon. In other words, you're not going home in a year or two. You're going to stay around here for quite a while, so get used to it. The picture that you see up there on the PowerPoint is actually not a depiction of Ezekiel. It's actually a depiction of the prophet Jeremiah, who was a contemporary with Ezekiel. Jeremiah was working on the people back in Jerusalem while Ezekiel was working on the captives in Babylon. And in Jeremiah chapter 27, God commands Jeremiah to place a yoke around his neck and to wear it in the presence of the people of Judah. And God's message to Judah, as well as to a lot of the other surrounding nations who Babylon would affect, is that they needed to subject themselves for the sake of their lives to the nation of Babylon. If they did not subject themselves, then God said he was going to kill them with the sword, with pestilence, and with famine. One of the problems in Jerusalem, however, as Jeremiah is walking around with this yoke and trying to convince the people to subject themselves, is that there are false teachers that are countering Jeremiah's message in order to try to appease the people. And so while he's doing this in Jeremiah 27, in Jeremiah 28, we read one of these prophets whose name is Hananiah. And Hananiah decides that he's going to deceitfully prophesy in front of Jeremiah, in front of the priests by the temple, and the people who are gathered at the temple, and claim that really Babylon's yoke would be broken within 2 years. That's what these false prophets were saying. Jeremiah argues with him. Hananiah doesn't like that, and so Hananiah takes that yoke on Jeremiah's neck and he breaks it to symbolize that that's what he thinks God is eventually going to do. God would punish Hananiah later by taking his life about 2 months later. But this pretense that God would restore Judah within 2 years by relieving them of Babylon's yoke didn't just exist in Jerusalem. It also existed among the exiles that were in Babylon at the time that Ezekiel is working with. And so both prophets are essentially fighting the same battle in different areas of the world in their respective territories. And so what we're going to do in this study this morning is we're going to look at the first of those four objectives that we talked about at the beginning. We're going to look at how God is going to use Ezekiel to get them to accept the yoke of Babylon, to get them to accept the fact that all of this that's been prophesied is going to come to pass, and you need to accept the fact that you're going to be in captivity for a while, that Jerusalem is going down, and stop listening to these false prophets. Now, in what way is God going to have Ezekiel do this in chapters 4 through 6? Does anybody know? Is it through necessarily preaching and speaking? Well, a little bit, but what's the primary way he's going to do it? He's going to do it through signs. He's going to have Ezekiel go through some very graphic and some really radical demonstrations right there in front of the people in order to cause wonder throughout the people so that he might have opportunity to tell them what it is that God is doing through him. And so by going through these demonstrations, by having Ezekiel go through these radical and these graphic demonstrations, God's objective is to show them the certainty of Jerusalem's destruction and the certainty and inevitability of their 70-year captivity. Okay, so in chapter 4, there's three things that God wants Ezekiel to do. First, he's going to command Ezekiel to build a model of a siege against Jerusalem right there on the ground. And then second, he's going to have him lay on his sides to bear the iniquity of Israel and Judah. And third, he's going to ask him to eat defiled bread. Now, it's important to remember that as Ezekiel is enacting these signs, he cannot speak unless God gives him an oracle to speak. This is something we read about at the end of chapter 3. He was going to cause his mouth to be mute. That didn't mean that he wasn't going to be able to speak at all. It just meant that he was only going to be allowed to say the things that God is allowing him to say. And so while he's going through these demonstrations, if God hasn't commanded him to speak and they're asking him questions, what are you doing, Ezekiel? Have you gone crazy? He's not allowed to say anything unless God tells him to say something. And that in itself would have been a sign to the people. So in chapter 4, verse 1 through 3, God commands Ezekiel to basically build a model enactment of a siege on the ground against Jerusalem. You almost get the picture when you read the first three verses of chapter 4 that he's almost like a little kid that's playing in the sand, you know, putting his cars here, putting his cars there, and kind of enacting this drama like little kids will do in a sandbox. Maybe not as childish, but you kind of get the idea that that's really what God is wanting him to do. In ancient times, when an army would besiege a city, they would set up a wall of soldiers completely surrounding that city with battering rams. They would build up mounds of dirt against the wall where their battering rams could break through strategic points in the wall and the soldiers could get through. And there's just a whole variety of things that would come into play when you're actually trying to besiege a city. And what God is having Ezekiel to do is enact all of this on the ground. And then we're also told in these three verses that he's to take an iron plate and to set it between himself and the city. Now, I believe the point of that sign, the iron plate, is that no matter how they felt and no matter what their false prophets were telling them, Jerusalem is going down. And the iron plate most likely signifies the fact that God is blocking his access to or from the people. And this is certainly something that's confirmed in Jeremiah. God told Jeremiah multiple times throughout his book, stop praying for these people. They're not going to be saved. Everything that I've said is going to happen because they've gone too far in their sin. And so I believe the iron plate is just a representation of that. And I'm blocking access from the people so that they're not going to be able to plead to me to prevent this judgment that I'm going to bring on their behalf. So in the darkest moments of the siege, you know, the people, they're going to become penitent. When things start to really get bad, they are going to cry out to God, but the iron plate would represent, you know, I'm not going to listen to your pleas because this is a time of judgment. Judgment is coming, and everything that I said is going to come to pass is going to come to pass. So he's doing that. He's building this model, and then in verses 4 through 8, God tells him to do something else. He wants him to lay on his sides for a particular amount of time. And he says he wants him to lay on his left side for 390 days to represent the sins of Jerusalem, a day for every year of the sins of Judah, that is, and then Israel, and then 40 days on his right side to represent a day for every year of the sins of Judah. Now, to find in Israelite history where these years days would correspond to actual years is something that has perplexed the most ablest of Bible scholars. And I will tell you, I've spent hours researching this, trying to connect this and trying to figure out what makes the most logical sense with these years, and I couldn't figure it out. It's very mind-blowing. The thing that I found that was the most likely interpretation of Israel's 390 years is that if you count the time between when Jeroboam first set up the idols at Dan and Bethel to the time that the last king in Judah was deposed, that is about 390 years. That was the closest I could find to represent that. I have no idea about the 40 years of Judah. If you count back from when Zedekiah was captured and count back 40 years, you get to about the middle of Josiah's reign. Could it be that? Possibly, I don't know. Some people have suggested that these years are not intended to be taken literally, but they could be very symbolic, like the numbers that we see in the book of Revelation. 40 years is usually a year of a probationary period or a punishment period. We think about the 40 years of or 40 days that Jesus was in the wilderness, the 40 years that Israel was in the wilderness. Some people have said that could be the years between Jesus' ministry and when Jerusalem fell in 70 AD. There's just a whole variety of interpretations. The thing we have to do as we're reading Ezekiel and we come to this and we're trying to make sense out of it is that if we can't make sense out of it, just get the overall picture. Just understand what the overall picture of it is. And the overall picture is that there is going to be a judgment. This has been something that's been long coming because the sins of Israel and Judah have been extensive. And imagine what the people must have been thinking as they're seeing Ezekiel lying on his side. I mean, they're coming up to him and he's just lying on his side. You know, I don't, in my mind somehow, I just kind of imagine he's got his head propped up with his fist. He's just kind of lying on his side, just sitting there. And that may or may not be the case, but he's lying on his side during that daytime period, most likely, and the people are just coming by, and all of a sudden, for 390 days, he's been doing this. Then he turns over on his other side. The people are going to be wondering, what are you doing, Ezekiel? What is this all about? This is extremely strange. It's as strange as if we were to walk out and see somebody in the middle of the road doing these kind of things that Ezekiel is doing. That was the point of it. It was supposed to cause the people to wonder and to think so that he could tell them what he's doing, and then when it actually happens, remember that phrase we see in Ezekiel? They will know that a prophet has been among them. Okay, so that's really the point of this, whether we really understand what the days represent or not. The other thing that he says there is that he's to uncover his arm. Probably the same thing that we do when we're setting out for a task that's pretty hefty. We kind of roll up our sleeves a little bit. The idea of uncovering his arm is to signify that God is ready to take action against his people, similar to us rolling up our sleeves. Any thoughts on those first two things before we look at that last part in chapter 4? Any comments, questions? Okay, the third sign in Ezekiel 4, 9 through 17, is that he is going to ask Ezekiel to eat defiled bread. Now, this is not what our modern society pushes in the form of that Ezekiel bread that you see in the grocery store. It's supposed to be some kind of really healthy bread. That's kind of where this came from, is this kind of idea. The point is not for them to eat an organic diet or anything crazy like that. That is not the point of this symbol. The point is that during a time of siege, when it's not a siege, that the Hebrews would only make bread of just one of the items that's listed. There are several mentioned: wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, spelt. They would make bread from just one of those items. But during a siege, there would be just sparse amounts of food present, and you would gain just a little bit here, a little bit there, whatever you could get your hands on, and you would just make do. And so the idea of Ezekiel gathering from all these multiple food sources is say, you know, we don't have a lot of just one thing, but we got a little bit of these things, and we're just going to do the best we can. And what God wants him to do is to take all that, make bread, and it's to symbolize the fact that, you know, during a siege, what's going to happen is some of the people are going to start starving. They're going to start starving to death. So he's going to give them a limited amount of this makeshift bread and water during the days that he is lying on his side and he's bearing the sins The units that are used in Ezekiel are a little bit strange, but if you do the math, it ends up being that Ezekiel was to eat about 8 ounces of bread a day and only 1 pint of water. Can you imagine that? I mean, we barely survive. 8 ounces of bread a day, 1 pint of water. And that's what he was to eat while he was laying on the side every day. And that was to symbolize what actually takes place during a city during a time of siege. But to make matters worse, what's the fuel that he's supposed to use for cooking? Well, it's a little gross, but God initially tells him, you're going to use as fuel human dung. And you see the little line scratched through there? That wasn't to protect this from the children, you know, in the audience, as much as it was, what was Ezekiel's reaction when God told him that? Did he like that? He said, no, I can't do that. That's unclean. And so God said, okay, then cow dung. Not much better, but maybe a hair better. And so the idea is when you're in a siege, you know, there's no wood. There's nothing to be used for fuel. I mean, you're probably, you know, burning up your wooden chest of drawers. I mean, you're using everything that you can to try to just prepare a basic meal. And when you run out of all that, what are you going to do? People during sieges would actually do this very thing that God is telling Ezekiel to do. And the people that are in exile knew that's what happened during sieges. And so, again, Ezekiel is doing all this stuff before the people of Jerusalem so that when it actually does happen, with what we're going to see here in Ezekiel chapter 24, they would know that a prophet has been among them. Any thoughts on those three signs there in chapter 4? Any comments or questions? Okay, let's move on to chapter 5. So that's what's going to happen to the city during a time of siege. What about to the actual people themselves that are in the city? In chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, God is going to have Ezekiel to cut some hairs from his beard and from his head. Now, I think it's important to mention this, the laying on the side thing. It's most likely that he did not do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, I'll tell you why that's the case. Number one, because God has Ezekiel doing some different things during this time period. The other reason is because when we get to this next vision, next week, beginning in chapter 8, that falls during the time frame of the 430 days that Ezekiel was to be laying on his side. And we're told at the beginning of that vision that he's sitting in a house with the elders of the people. So it's most likely that what he's doing in this the siege and this food and lying on his side, that's kind of just taking place during the part of the day which would have been when people would have been out and about and doing their daily business. And then probably he would pack up and go home at night, come back and do the same thing over again. That's what we speculate anyway. And I say that to say this, you know, he is supposed to go out and he's supposed to cut these hairs from his head and from his beard, and he's doing all these various things with him. A third of it was to be burned with fire. A third of his hair was to be struck with the sword in the presence of the people. A third was to be scattered with the sword all about. And then he was to take a few hairs bound in his robe, and then even some of those he was to take and to burn in fire. In Israelite culture, if you were not taking like a Nazirite vow or something like that, but you were just an ordinary Israelite, If your head was shaved or if your beard was plucked out, that was a symbol and a sign of disgrace. Oftentimes, foreign invaders, and the Assyrians love to do this, but foreign invaders were known for humiliating their captives by plucking the captive's beard out and shaving their head in order to disgrace them. And I think the point is that God is having Ezekiel go through this demonstration not to shame Ezekiel, but to show the shame that is going to be brought to the house of Israel because of their sins. And so a third of his hair is going to be burned with fire. That's what's going to happen to the people. A third is going to be struck with the sword. A third are going to be scattered to the wind. And a few of these hairs are going to be bound in the edges of the robe and be burned with fire. We are not told explicitly what that means like we are the other things, but I think it's pretty obvious from the text that that means that a very small remnant of people are going to be spared from the judgment that God plans on bringing to the majority of people in the city at that time. The meaning is given, though, for the others in the latter part of the text of Ezekiel 5. A third of the people are going to die in the city of pestilence and famine. This would include disease, it would include starvation, and any of the natural things that would come with being holed up in a city with no access in or out, running out of food, running out of water, no way to to separate people who get sick and all the disease that would become rampant during a time like that. So a third of the people are going to die of pestilence, of famine. A third of the people are going to just take a run for it, you know, press their luck, see if they can get through that wall of soldiers. Ain't going to happen. They're going to be killed by sword. And then a third of the people are actually going to get away, but they're going to be scattered, but the sword is going to follow them. In other words, they're going to break through, but they're going to be followed and killed eventually anyway. And again, we said that the few that he was abiding to his robe probably represents the remnant, but the fact that he was to even take some of those and put them in the fire means that though a remnant is going to be spared, they're going to go through a lot of hardship along the way to get to that point. So the point of this in Ezekiel 5 is that things are going to get so bad in Jerusalem during this three-year siege that the people are going to starve to death. They're going to look for any way to escape from the judgment and the destruction that Babylon is inflicting. But God sees the sin of Israel. He sees it as so great. He says, it's not going to happen. You're not going to escape. You know, basically, choose your death. You know, choose your death. Are you going to die this way, that way, or this way? Your sin has just got to the point. This is not a time for mercy. This is a time for judgment. And that's what these signs represent here. You know, all of this was prophesied back in Leviticus chapter 26, if you get a chance sometime, go back and read Leviticus chapter 26, verse 27 through 33. Leviticus 27 through 33. You'll remember that after the worship was set up, after the priesthood was set up, the tabernacle and all that, God says, when you come into this land, basically behave yourselves, do my law, do the things that I've asked you to do. If you don't, here's what I'm going to do to you. And it's amazing when you go back and read Leviticus 26, verse 27 through 33, all the things that we're talking about that are going to happen during the siege are things that God had predicted hundreds and hundreds of years prior. But the Israelites, unfortunately, were disillusioned, even though they had this as a part of their law. And this is why Ezekiel is having to perform these very radical signs in front of them to try to break through the hardness of their hearts and get them to see the consequences of their actions. Any thoughts on that in chapter 5 before we move on to chapter 6? We've got some time for questions or comments if you have any. Is there an exciting basketball game or something? You guys are quiet this morning. that's okay. Let's go on to chapter 6. Now what God is going to have Ezekiel to do in this chapter is he's going to have him to face toward the mountains of Israel and to prophesy against the mountains. What was something that Israelites liked to do with the mountains throughout that time? Idol worship, right? Yeah. Not rock climbing, not hiking, though I'm sure some of them have done that, but they really like to use them for idol worship. Think about how many times the high places are mentioned in the Old Testament scriptures, particularly during the times of the kings. Sometimes they would worship Jehovah on these high places, even though God told them in Deuteronomy 12, verse 11, that he would be the one to choose where they worship. But more often than not, they would worship idols on these high places. Moses had exhorted the people all the way back in the book of Numbers, chapter 33, that when they go in and they take the land, they are to destroy these high places so that these high places wouldn't become a temptation to them. But we know that during the book of Joshua, after they took about, say, 80 to 90% of that territory, they got a little bit lazy and decided they wanted to settle down. You ever started a project and got 90% done and that was close enough? That was kind of how the Israelites were when it came to conquering the land. And so they left a lot of these nations surrounding them, and that ended up in turn negatively influencing them. And one of the things they were influenced to do was to worship these idols on the high places. A lot of the kings in the Old Testament that did a lot of good reforming of the nation, kings like Asa and Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah, they did great things, but one of the things that would always follow all the good things that they did is, but they could not rid the high places. And it's almost like, oh, they got so far, but they couldn't get the high places out of there. But Josiah did. That's why he was one of the great kings. Josiah was one of the ones that completely destroyed the high places. He destroyed all the priests that were worshiping on the high places, destroyed the idols, burned them in ashes. But guess what happened after Josiah died? The people just picked up right where they left off, because Josiah, while he could reform the nation physically, he could not get to their heart, which is something that Jeremiah tells us as well. And so all that history aside, that's why we have an Ezekiel chapter 6. That's why Ezekiel is going through this radical demonstration of prophesying against the mountains of Israel, because God recognizes how much these mountains and these high places have really just become a thorn in the side of Israel. And so God is not just interested in destroying Jerusalem and giving the people judgment. He's interested in doing away with this concept of the high places, and so he's going to go through this oracle of prophesying against them and basically say the same sword and judgment that's going to take away Jerusalem is also going to take you away, high places, sort of personifying these mountains, so to speak. But we also read in chapter 6 that he's going to preserve a remnant. And that's one thing we want to make sure we pay attention to as we read the book of Ezekiel, because the book of Ezekiel is a hard book. I mean, it's judgment, judgment without mercy, judgment, judgment. And there are going to be times, as you're going to see next week, that Ezekiel is going to become so overwhelmed in his humanity with what God is doing to the people that he's just going to break down and say, "Oh, God, you're going to just destroy us all. There's not going to be a remnant left." And God would say, "No, I am going to spare a remnant. I still do have plans for you." And this is one of those occasions where God says towards the end of chapter 6 that he is going to preserve a remnant of Judah, that those who are currently being rebellious, they are going to learn the errors of their way. They will learn true contrition while they are in the nations to which they have been scattered. And while they're there, he says, they're going to turn back to the Lord. And again, we'll learn later on that God intends to use this repentant remnant that is already in exile from the first and second deportation to actually be the ones to go back and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem once their 70 years are complete. And then the final thing we see in chapter 6 is that Ezekiel is to go through this thing where he's clapping his hand, stamping his foot. This is the only time you're going to see me clapping in a worship, you know, in a church building. You know, we don't do that, obviously, during our worship, and for good reason. But that wasn't the kind of clapping that Ezekiel was to do. This expression of clapping and just stamping your foot, it was an expression of mixed emotion, an expression of amazement, sorrow, and pity, just a whole lot of emotions over just the impact of everything that's transpiring here. The people who were carried away by their idolatrous tendencies, they would be smote by sword, famine, and plague in response to God's wrath. And that was to be something that just overtook Ezekiel with so many emotions he didn't know how to express himself. And so that's where the clapping and the stomping of the foot would come in. And God recognizes that. He recognizes that this is the darkest day that Israel is ever going to see, what I'm planning to bring on them. And so he has Ezekiel to go through those gestures that would normally accompany just complete amazement over what's about to transpire. So, okay, well, that's Ezekiel chapter 6. Any thoughts or comments on that? Okay, well, now what we're going to do is we're going to skip over to chapter 24. Why are we skipping on that forward? Well, I'm trying to attack the book of Ezekiel a little bit topically rather than going through just chapter by chapter. This morning what we're trying to deal with is that God is wanting to get them to see that the yoke of Babylon is here to stay. Next week and the week after, we're going to look at the chapters where God is trying to get them to own up to their sin. But chapter 24, I think, falls in line with everything that we have been talking about, because chapter 24 is really a watershed moment. Go ahead, Matt. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the specific date is not mentioned, but we assume, because that does seem to be a collection of oracles and signs there, that's probably what was happening. Yeah, so he would not have been perpetually laid on the side. But the sign that I was mentioning that comes in chapter 8 when God takes them in a vision to Jerusalem, if you count the days from when chapter 4 starts and then look at the day when the vision in chapter 8 starts, that comes in the 430 years that he would have been laying on his side. And that's why we say that he was probably not doing that 24 hours a day, just during the span of time when people would see him, basically. So, yeah. Any other comments? Okay, so as I said, this is Ezekiel 24 is kind of a watershed moment in the book of Ezekiel because it is the day that Ezekiel has been prophesying about for the last several years. We're skipping ahead a few years, and he's been going through these signs, going through these radical demonstrations. And what does God tell him is significant about this very day in Ezekiel chapter 24? Nebuchadnezzar has now come to Jerusalem, and it is this day that he has started the siege. Now, how in the world would Ezekiel know that? You know, there's no email back then. There's no FaceTime. There's no way to just know what's going on hundreds of miles away from you. It would take days, maybe weeks or months for somebody to come and to let them know what was happening. And so the fact that God's saying, here's a day, this is when it's happening, when it gets back to the people, when that's happened, and Ezekiel's already written down the day, he's already made that a public proclamation, we assume from this, that was going to be another sign. The date is 589 BC. It's 4 years after Ezekiel has begun prophesying. And the siege of Babylon is going to last for 3 years. 3 whole years it's going to take them to destroy the city. And think about all these things that he's been radically demonstrating are actually going to start coming to pass in the city at this time. And again, the fact that Ezekiel has this information was a miraculous sign in and of itself. And this would again be a sign for the people to remember that indeed Ezekiel was a prophet. In verses 3 through 14 of Ezekiel 24, God's going to give Ezekiel this image of an ordinary cooking pot in which you would boil meat. And yet the meat is boiling and it's boiling and it's boiling, and the heat is just so intense that even the bones are starting to seethe in the pot. What this pot represents is it represents the city of Jerusalem, and the heat is on, basically, is what God is saying. Things are starting to boil over. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem are being boiled in a pot because, again, this is God's judgment. And Jerusalem is also likened to this, some of your versions will say rust, some of it will say scum. In the pot, you ever had that pot that's been just cooked so much that you've got this kind of scum or rust on the side and you can't get rid of it, and you just kind of boil it and boil it and boil it, but it just you can't get rid of it. That's kind of the idea that's going on here, is it can't be cleansed, so God is going to have to cleanse this by excessively boiling this pot, removing the pieces, and just turn up the heat so much until that rust and that scum is just melted off. And so before the meat is put in the pot to cook, you know, normally what you would do with meat is especially if it just came off the bone of the animal, is that you would drain the meat of its blood. But we're told in this illustration that the contents of the pot are being boiled with the blood still in them. And so that would represent just the utter repulsiveness and the uncleanness of the contents of that pot, or the contents of Jerusalem, that this is what the people basically are. They're unclean, they're disgusting, and I've got to do something about this. I've got to get this uncleanness and this immorality out of this pot. And so that's what he's going through right now, and he's giving him this vision on the very day that the siege has begun to remind Ezekiel 4 years later, here's why I'm having to do this. Things have just got to a point where I can't hear their pleas anymore. It's a time for judgment. We got 5 minutes left. Let me just mention this, and boy, this is going to be the one that really gets to us here. The other sign he gives in chapter 24 is about his wife. Ezekiel is married. We don't really know that up until this point, but we are told that God is going to cause Ezekiel's wife to die, and that itself is going to be a sign to the people. Because how was Ezekiel supposed to react when his wife would die? Well, how does God tell him he is to react? Don't show any sorrow. Don't mourn her publicly. Don't show any emotion before the people. Could you do that if God took your spouse? That'd be kind of tough. You ever, you know, sometimes emotions are, they just come. You can't really help it. You ever, you know, spanked your kid and you're really angry and he's crying at you and you say, don't cry. And he goes, I'm sorry, I'm trying not to. You know, he's trying not to cry, but he's just so overcome with emotion. We can't help that sometimes. Well, there can be some confusion about this. Is God telling Ezekiel not to have any emotion at all? I actually don't think that's really the point of this. In cultures, in ancient cultures, and even today, cultures express their grief in a lot of different ways. In Eastern Oriental cultures, like we would see here with these Jews, it was very common to honor a person who died with very grandiose and outward displays of sorrow. So Israelites would rend their garments, which we read about in the scriptures. They would sit on the ground, remove their head garment. They would pour ashes on their head. They would remove their shoes. They would cover the lower part of their face with a cloth. Even in Jeremiah chapter 16 and verse 7, Jeremiah mentions a bread of mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, that would often accompany times of grief. Is that the first bell? Okay, so all of these were outward signs that you would display, I guess, a loved one. And the point of going through this display is to show people that you are honoring the passing of your loved one. And so I think, I'm speculating what's happening here, is that God is not telling Ezekiel, you are to have no emotion whatsoever for the death of your wife, so much as he is to say, when you're before the people, what you would normally do when your wife dies, I don't want you to do that. None of this grandstanding, none of these grandiose outward symbols or signs of honoring the dead. Because why? What was Ezekiel's wife's death supposed to represent in this story? That's right, the judgment of Jerusalem. Ezekiel's wife was the delight of Ezekiel's eyes. What was the delight of a Jewish person's eyes? It was Jerusalem, and it was the temple. And that's going down for a very good reason. We don't know if Ezekiel's wife is dying for a very good reason. We're not told. We're just, you know, it's just sometimes unfortunate to be a prophet and have to be the subject of some of these signs and symbols like Ezekiel was. But the point is, Jerusalem is going down, and she deserves to go down. She is not to be honored in any such way. When you hear that the temple has been destroyed, when you hear that the walls have gone down, don't honor, because this is judgment. And you need to get on the same page with me that this is something that needed to happen. And that's the point of this. And you know, we can say, well, couldn't he have gotten this message across, you know, some other way? Why did he have to kill Ezekiel's wife to get them to see that? And you know, we can ask that question till we die. And when we see God on Judgment Day, we can ask him then. But the point is, that's what he did. And again, these signs are intended to be radical because there had been prophets trying to help the Jews for years and years and years, and they couldn't get things through their head. And so it's almost like, I'm going to try a more radical technique now. And so unfortunately, Ezekiel's wife is going to die, and the whole point of the not mourning was to show that this is how I want the people to respond in this way when Jerusalem goes down. Don't you outwardly mourn for this place. Don't you go through the normal mourning procedures that you would do when you hear that Jerusalem has finally fallen, because this is judgment and they had it coming, basically. That didn't mean that God wasn't sad that he was having to do this to his people. I'm sure he was. But it had to happen because this is a time of judgment. Any thoughts on that? That's a tough one. Matt. Yeah, that's a good kind of a parallel illustration that this would cause shock in people and be like, why is he doing that? Yeah, that's a good point. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, remember when Nadab and Abihu died? It says that Aaron held his peace. Why? Divine judgment. You know, who's more important, that God be honored or that you mourn over sinful children who have disrespected the king of the cosmos? So, yeah, that's good parallel. All right, I'm going to be out of town next Sunday. Jared has graciously agreed to finish the rest of the book for you guys. No. He's going to go through chapters 8 through 11 next week.